Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
Live from the John L. Santikos studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Less than 3% of the United States budget is spent on public health. That's about $286 per person. But on average, a U.S. citizen will spend about $12,000 per year on health care. That sets up a weird dichotomy of why do we spend so little on public health, yet we spend the most in the world on health care for individual. That sets up a question of me versus us, a health divided. That's the title of the new book by public health thought leader Michael Stein, and he is also the author, professor, chair of the health law policy and management at Boston University School of Public Health, and his latest release is Me versus Us, a health divided. And doctor, welcome to The Source.
Dave, thanks for having me.
So you focus on life expectancy, that this is the key thing that we should look at to show us we got a problem in the United States. So tell me about that.
Yeah, life expectancy is a pretty good measure of our general health as a population, as a nation. And that life expectancy, as you know, has dropped in the past couple of years, but it's really been worse than that. I mean, if you think back to the 1990s, the average life expectancy in the U.S. was not much different from anywhere in Europe, from Germany, from United Kingdom, Spain. But right now, it's considerably worse. That is, American babies are more likely to die before they turn 5, and American teenagers are more likely to die before they turn 20, and American adults are more likely to die before they turn 65. That Europe just has better health outcomes than the U.S. across the board. And that wasn't true 30 years ago. So the idea that America is so exceptional in so many things, yet 40th in the world in life expectancy, is just a shocking number to many of us.
And why is that acceptable?
Well, I don't think it's acceptable. Europe has better health outcomes than the U.S. across the board for white and black people in high poverty areas and low poverty areas. It's just not acceptable. But I think until we sort of admit that it's a fact and B, that we may want to pay attention to it, we can't really attend to it.
Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can tweet at us at TPRSource. Send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. Do you think that we should be investing more in public health? And what were the big lessons that you learned about public health as an infrastructure during COVID-19? So, Dr. Stein, what did you think that we should have learned from COVID-19?
There are a lot of things that we should have learned. We should have learned, first of all, that even though you can have a pandemic come out of the blue, that it really reflects sort of underlying problems in society's health. That is, a pandemic, you would think, especially one that's airborne like COVID, should affect people randomly across the population. Anybody should get COVID, and that wasn't the case in this pandemic, particularly during the first year when people were dying before there was a vaccine. What you saw was that the burden of COVID fell on populations that have always had burdens in the United States. And they were older people, prisoners, people of color. There were a variety of populations or subpopulations in the United States that were affected. And that's because we don't really pay attention to those populations before a bad thing like a pandemic arrives. So I think that was number one. I mean, I think certain other lessons are clear, which is that pandemics, and we will have others after COVID, are really the only hope of controlling them early on is by surveillance, by knowing that they're coming. That's a public health function. It's a preventive function. It says we're at risk, and we need to know how we're at risk and where we're at risk from.
But, you know, we had something like that, but it was dismantled before COVID happened.
It was partly dismantled. I mean, we've spent very little money on public health in the United States for decades, and COVID set us up for that. I mean, it displayed that problem very urgently. So that was another problem, that we didn't have surveillance that was in place. I mean, there were other problems that COVID made clear to us as well. But the idea of sort of paying attention to populations, paying attention to preventing illness, and then instituting policies that can address some of these problems is where we've fallen out in public health. And those are the three functions of public health.
So in your title, Me Versus Us, and thinking about what it was like during the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, and I think about how there was that fighting about wearing a mask, you know, here in Texas, that became people didn't want to wear a mask. And we would tell them, well, it's really not to protect you, it's to protect others. And this is how we slow the spread. This is how we flatten the curve. And then people say, I don't care. I don't want to wear a mask. And we had that, you know, toxic individualism. We're saying, well, it's about me, it's not about us. And you do write about that a bit in your book.
Yeah. You know, our ethos in America around health is around self-help and individualism, right? That we think of life in general as an individual journey, and we think of health as an individual journey. That if we're rich enough, that we should be able to pay attention to what we eat and how much we sleep and how much we exercise, and we can optimize our own health. And that's how we think. We go to a health care provider when we need one, and that's where we take care of ourselves. So that's the story of me. The story of us, which is a public health ethos, is very different, where we have to think of ourselves as part of a group and what's of public good, and that benefits are not immediately and specifically coming to you in public health, but that there is a greater good for our kids, for our grandkids, for our neighbors, et cetera. It's the classic endless American dilemma, right, of the self versus the community. It's Emerson versus Thoreau. It's Freud versus Marx. It's a central divide of the American experience, I think, at this point, and it plays out in all sorts of health ways.
Sure. It's comedy when you slip on a banana peel, but it's tragedy when I slip on a banana peel.
Exactly. Exactly. Talking about banana peels is a story that I tell in the book a little bit, where I make the differentiation between all the attention we give to health care versus this idea of health, which is all the conditions of the world that allow us to avoid, in fact, seeking health care. Remember, health care is, in a sense, sick care, right? We only seek health care when we're sick in most cases. So I have a friend who's a president of a hospital, and she says, you know, I had this 50-year-old person come into our hospital who had, you know, slipped in this pothole, and, you know, she broke her hip, and she came to the emergency room of the hospital, and we treated her in the emergency room, we did the x-rays, we did the CAT scan, we got in a surgeon, we brought her to the operating room, we put in an artificial hip, we took care of her for 4 days, we sent her to rehab, she got a $75,000 bill. We did this beautifully because we can do this sort of line of care in the United States. She says, but, you know, who takes care of the pothole?
Yeah, in the meantime, the pothole exists, and we can see that almost everything in our built environment, from the way our streets are paved, to the way our buildings are made, to the food that we buy at the store, everything around us, it impacts our public health. And we should maybe adopt a stronger mindset about that. And we're going to talk about that some more when we come back from the break. If you got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Do you feel a connection to public health? This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas's largest research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the next half hour, we're going to be discussing Is it time to talk peace with Russia and bring to a close the invasion of Ukraine? And what would that look like? But right now we're talking about public health, me versus us, the health divide. And we're joined by Dr. Michael Stein. He is the author of the book, Me versus Us. So you say the opposite of public health is public suffering. And I think we all should have the goal to reduce suffering in every form, in every way that we can. So if we invest in public health, will we reduce public suffering?
Well, I think that, yes, I think we would. I mean, let's take a very common public health problem, one that we're all very aware of. So it's overweight, it's obesity. We have, in the past 50 years, increased obesity in the United States in dramatic ways. And affecting the health of people and affecting their risk of diabetes and heart disease and other health problems that I would say cause suffering. And that has gone on for 50 years, despite lots of diet books and lots of diet programs and lots of diet surgeries and diet pills. So what is it? What's going on that for 50 years we've spent all this money on sort of the healthcare approach to diet, and yet it's not gotten any better? And the answer is, it's because of the world we live in, right? It's the food systems that we live with that dictate our production and processing and preparation and how we eat food. Any person who is trying to diet is fighting a food system that's shaped by corn and sugar subsidies and economic factors. And that makes it hard for any individual. So when people say to me, listen, you know, people who are overweight, it's their responsibility. It's this personal responsibility. They should be able to fix this themselves. Well, you know, that's hard to accept if 50% of people are dealing with that. Is it really that we have 50% of our population are weak people? No. It's really that it's that our eating contexts are shaped by social and cultural influences. And until we address those, I think we're not going to address suffering in general, and obesity in particular in this case.
We go to a caller. Our number is 833-TPR-TALK, and we have Nicole. Nicole, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask if you, in your opinion, do you think that gun violence in America is a public health problem, and would it be helpful to start looking at it that way, to take a public health approach and helping to curb it?
Thank you for the call, Nicole.
Nicole, thanks so much. I absolutely think it's a public health problem. I think that there are a few reasons, to get back to the beginning of our conversation here, that have caused life expectancy to drop in the United States. That was even before COVID, and of course made worse by COVID. And that high death rate is due in good part to guns, in part to drugs and alcohol, in part due to cars and driving, as well as other sort of more social problems that would include poverty in the largest sense and housing problems in general. But certainly guns would be on the top of the list, right? I mean, tens of thousands of people are dying of gun injuries each year. And, you know, we spend a lot of time in the media talking about sort of mass murders, which would be four or more people killed in a single episode. But that's a great minority of all the gun deaths in America, where there are tens of thousands per year. And then add to that, 10 times that number are severe injuries. So it's not just deaths, it's injuries that are contributing both to a shorter life expectancy in the United States, as well as much suffering. And therefore, given the breadth of the problem, I call large problems like that public health problems, ones that we need to address.
But like you said, the low-hanging fruit you say we ought to look at is obesity in the United States, but we have a multi-billion-dollar food industry that's going to fight you on that. What's the easy pickings that we could do to try to improve health outcomes in the U.S.?
Yeah, I don't think there are particularly easy pickings, frankly. I think that there are very few of them. I think that there are things like vaccinations that we know work very well and we are resistant to up and down the board in the United States, right? Even before COVID, where the minority of Americans have gotten this sort of full booster pack of COVID protection. You know, we only have 40 or 50% of Americans getting flu vaccines. So I think which kills tens of thousands of people every year, right? Between 30 and 80,000 people will die of the flu this year. And I think until we sort of do simple things like vaccinations, which is, again, a sort of basic public health priority, then I think we're lost. But I do think that the larger issues, such as alcohol use, opioid problems, gun safety, those preventable causes of death are really all achieved, as well as obesity, are achieved only through policy. And that really comes over time and in many parts, as we've seen with cigarette smoking, right?
Right, and seatbelts and stuff like that. But, you know, policy would be, hey, let's have universal health care. Let's expand Medicaid. Here in Texas, we have the largest number, the highest percentage of people who have no insurance. They have no access to health care.
Well, absolutely. Public health is politics. I mean, that's how each of us individually, who feel overwhelmed by all the large problems of the world, are left with thinking of public health as a political decision. That when we vote, anytime we vote, and we just had an election that was decided based on many issues, one of the issues, and it's not just at federal elections or even state elections, but at county and city elections, there should be a consideration of policy's health effects. We should be asking our candidates when we vote, does that policy have an effect on the health of my neighborhood, the health of my community? And if we're very broad-minded, you know, the life expectancy and health of our nation over time. And we need to persuade ourselves that it's best to think of health in a public way and not only as individuals all the time, that we need to sort of get outside of our immediate interests because these things come back to us.
All right, let's go to Beverly on the phones. And Beverly, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is this. I'm a public health nurse, so I see a lot of the things that you've been talking about. But as a chronic pain patient myself, I also understand the opioid crisis, but I am having a lot of difficulty in getting people to truly manage pain. And I see this as a precursor to the increase in suicide rates. What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for the call, Beverly. Doctor?
Yeah, we've had an opioid crisis since around 2008. It's been at its peak even into the last year. The highest, over 100,000 people died of opioid overdose in the United States. There are lots of reasons for that, from both commercial reasons, businesses that are now in the crosshairs of lawyers and lawsuits, to down to individual providers who are not following recommended guidelines in terms of prescribing opioids. Pain is a growing problem, a continued growing problem in the United States, I think in part due to overweight, which puts a lot of pressure on our joints. That's one of the underlying reasons of chronic pain in the United States, but certainly there's emotional pain and despair as well that manifests as physical pain. And you know, we have 30 or 40% of our population now has chronic pain. And we need to think of ways to manage chronic pain at the individual level that don't involve opioids, and at the policy level in ways, again, that make dying of pain control difficult.
All right, we got multi-generational trauma as well. Let's go to Viola. Viola, you're on the air.
Hi. Before I finish my question, perhaps after I finish, you can repeat the doctor's name and his book. My question is, how can we increase the funding to the public health system? Are there any groups that push for funding for public health that we could contribute to or join?
Right. And is it a local problem as well? Should it just be going to our city council demanding more funding for the local for public health, or is it national? So Dr. Michael Steen and his problem is his book is Me Versus Us, A Health Divided.
Viola, what a great question. Are there advocacy groups for public health? Well, in the political sphere, not that I know of. There's the American Public Health Association, which advocates for many wonderful policies across the board. And public health, the actual work of public health, is confusing in the United States, right? We don't really have a single public health system that we can speak to or speak against. We have instead 100 mini systems that are networks of cities and counties and state health departments. I think part of the difficulties with public health is that as citizens, we're confused. We know where to go when we need urgent medical care. We know where the hospital and the emergency room is, but where do we go to get public health is sort of a question, and it's complicated. The Centers of Disease Control, which is famous for being the center of public health in the United States, really doesn't have the final authority over the hundreds of mini systems of public health in the United States. So the answer is find your local or city or state health department, see how you might be able to be most helpful to them, Viola. And in terms of large advocacy groups, the American Public Health Association might be the way to go. But really a great question.
So you write about the invisible benefit of public health. So when we all watch It's a Wonderful Life over the holidays, we should be thinking about public health?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So the story of A Wonderful Life, as you know, is a sort of Christmas movie where one of the characters, George Bailey, is a banker. He's on the verge of scandal. He's not sure what to do. And there's a person in the movie who turns out, whose name is Clarence, and Clarence may be an angel, and he can show George what the future would be like if he chooses path one or path two. And so that notion of sort of looking into the future to see how hideous it can be if you make a particular decision is sort of what public health wishes it could do, right? It says, you know, public health wants to prevent things. We don't want to have the hideous future. But if we showed you the hideous future, we could convince you more easily of how good prevention is. You know, so it's this wonderful idea of sort of being able to look in the future and seeing the sort of an alternate history. And that's what prevention is. Prevention is an alternate history, and how we keep the world from becoming worse. You know, one of the funniest lines that I know is from The Simpsons, where Homer Simpson says, you know, we're always buying Maggie vaccinations for diseases she doesn't even have, right? So that's what prevention is. It's vaccinations against preventing diseases so that you never have them and then don't think about what you might have had.
Right, but so public health should work in a way that it's invisible. We don't see all these infections. We're not supposed to see polio and smallpox and big outbreaks of measles if it's working.
It is invisible, exactly right. I mean, we see those emergencies that affect our water and our food and our air. We understand when Jackson, Mississippi has its drinking water disrupted and all the water in the town and the city is contaminated and businesses and schools are disrupted and families can't wash their hands and they lose the use of their toilets. That's when public health is not working. You can see it in those kinds of emergencies. In the meantime, what public health departments are doing to prevent that should be monitoring, surveilling for all sorts of health risks. And so public health departments do work that you never see, but that we pay for through our taxes that pay for about 300,000 public health workers in the United States who test the water safety of our lakes and our ponds and the pools that we swim in and the drinking water that comes out of our schools. And they do food inspections at restaurants and at packing plants, and they check for rodents at campgrounds. And if all of those things are done, we hopefully don't have foodborne illness outbreaks and water problems. And that's what we want public health to do. And that's what we need to pay for before we see the emergencies.
And hopefully after COVID-19, we've learned these important lessons and we will have a stronger health public health system, and we know that it is for all of us, not just for a few. And so Dr. Michael Stein, thank you so much. Author, professor, chair of health law policy and management at Boston University School of Public Health. His latest book is Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about the Russian-Ukraine war and whether now is the time to call for peace. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.